Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SERFM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
It helps them break free from poverty and it helps them understand their own rights as a human being and how they can advocate for themselves and others as well.
October 11 is the start of the International Year of the Child. And here on The Wire Weekly, we take a look at the consequences for girls around the world who are forced into child marriages. So stay with us here on The Wire Weekly. But first, 20 years ago, bombs detonated across Bali in Indonesia, where 20 people were killed and 129 were injured in a series of attacks on the Indonesian island. A Newcastle-based survivor of the bombings has created a podcast looking into the motivations of the killers and the stories of survivors. Joe Frost was just a few feet away from one of the bombs when it detonated. Peter Hislop asked Joe Frost to reflect on the bombings 20 years on.
I always knew what had happened to me, and I suppose I had a fairly good outline of what had happened to the rest of our group from Newcastle on that night. But it was only a few years ago that I started to process how much bigger this whole thing was, that, you know, three suicide bombers attacked in coordination, and something like that doesn't just happen. It needs an enormous level of coordination and not just coordination, but like creating bombs, you know, like there's know-how involved in that. You know, the internet isn't what it is today in 2005. It wasn't something you could just Google. So who taught these people how to make the bombs? And the people that did it had been on the run, you know, they were wanted men. So who was putting them up? You know, how were they managing to evade the law? How were they buying their meals? You know, like just the money that's required just to live your life day to day. This whole thing, it was so much bigger than I had ever really aimed to process, I suppose, is the way to put it. And when I started to ask those really, I guess, basic questions, it started to lead to some very complex answers. And the more that I asked, the more I realized I didn't know. And therefore, I didn't get answers. I just got better questions to ask.
I guess one thing I did want to ask is what you remember and some of the first things that you remember experiencing after the blast.
So there were two bombs on the beach, and the first bomb went off to the north of the table that I was sitting at, which was to my left. So I was just looking to the left at what was the ensuing chaos. There were, you know, hundreds of people running and screaming and, you know, reacting as you would expect from a bomb having gone off. And I don't know why, but I just sort of thought, oh, well, you know, our bomb has gone off. I guess that's that. And I was scared, but I just thought it was over. You know, and it wasn't. And then the next thing I knew, I was face down in the sand and my ears were ringing and my legs were burning. And I think, as I've said before, that the chaos came to us.
I guess this disaster it kind of plays second fiddle to the 2002 disaster. And you've mentioned this and it's a lot harder to find information. I guess that would have been really frustrating and concerning for families, particularly at the time.
I suppose at the time, you know, it's all over the papers and it was a big story then. But by the time you're sort of talking 15, 20 years later, when I started to do research for the podcast, you know, you Google Bali 2005 and you get sent to pages about the 2002 Bali bombing. I remember one of the first searches I did on ChatGPT, I said, tell me about the 2005 Bali bombing. And it said, well, the 2005 Bali bombing happened in 2002 and told me all about the 2002 Bali bombing. And I'm, you know, found that it was just sort of happening over and over again. So initially, it was very frustrating that had, I suppose, overshadowed this other event. But then I started to think, well, if the story's not been told, well, then there's an opportunity for me to tell it. And as I say, I started to ask questions and that led me to people who had answers and that led me to more people who had more answers. And as I dug deeper, I initially had thought that this was a story that people had forgotten, but I came to understand that it was a story that people didn't know.
For sure. And a lot of people in Newcastle, of course, were affected by this and, you know, new people that had died in this disaster, I guess. There's this memorial coming up on Wednesday, of course. There'd be a lot of people affected by this and I'd imagine it'd be a fairly emotional event.
Yeah, it's as you say, a lot of people from Newcastle were involved. There were 18 of us from Newcastle on the beach. 15 of us survived the event. And within that, most of the people who were on the beach from Newcastle were parents. So there were another sort of 30 or so of people back at the hotel that were largely a group of high school kids and even some primary school kids. So, you know, I think it's easy to think, oh, you know, how does it affect the people who were there on the beach and the people that survived the blast itself? But it wasn't until years later that I started to process, like, you know, there was a 10-year-old boy there, you know, and he was technically safe the whole time, but how scared he must have been and how that must have been such a formative event for him.
You mentioned you've done this this big investigation, you've done this podcast. I guess, has finding out some more information about the killers and their motivations, I guess, broadly put you at more peace about what happened, or kind of made you feel more, not at ease, but I guess just, yeah, feeling more a bit of closure maybe in regards to what happened that day?
It's a tricky one because I don't think there ever is closure with something like this. And I have been asked by a few people why I did it. And I guess because it was there. It's always going to be there. And it was a bit of a black box. There was just this thing that happened and it was horrible and it was really, really formative in my life. And it was only in the last few years that I started to process that I hadn't processed it, that I didn't know what happened.
Joe Frost, Bali bombing survivor and podcaster, speaking there with 2NUR's Peter Hislop.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Australian diplomatic staff in Israel have reported serious mistreatment of Australian activists involved in attempting to breach Israel's naval blockade of Gaza. The claims of maltreatment also included physical beatings. It now appears that all 7 Australian citizens have been deported from Israel to Jordan. A spokesperson for Foreign Minister Penny Wong said the government was pleased that they have been released from detention. James Bale asked Associate Professor Srinjoy Bose from the University of New South Wales how the flotilla could have expected to be able to break through the Gaza blockade.
Not just the Israeli Navy, it's the Israeli administration. Their strategic motive is to punish people who disagree with Israel and are outspoken about the genocide against Palestinians. Individuals such as the Minister of National Security, Ben-Gvir, repeatedly conflated Hamas with Palestinians, the implication being all Palestinians are terrorists. By extension, their logic is that anyone who supports Palestinians and or speaks out against the Israeli genocide is a supporter of terrorism, thereby giving them the necessary justification to detain activists, peace activists, who were part of the Sukkot flotilla. So that's the overall strategic rationale.
Would Israelis' use of torture tactics, which were in the report, so there was physical violence, no access to bathrooms, would this be considered a war crime?
This entire episode detracts away from the genocide against Palestinians and the treatment of Palestinians in Israeli prisons, more often than not without charge, without trial, right? The treatment of Palestinians and Palestinian children in Israeli prisons is now well documented. The use of torture, sexual assault is commonplace, which would be in contravention to the human treatment of prisoners, regardless of whether they are charged as prisoners of war or otherwise. So that's, I think, the real issue.
Also in this report, it was claimed that a Israeli soldier tore up the passport of one of the Australian activists. So how would a country hypothetically respond to that?
I suppose what this demonstrates is that consular support by nations is paramount. The Australian administration is responsible for its citizens overseas. In other words, whether the administration agrees or disagrees with the viewpoints and, in this instance, the actions of peace activists who are part of the flotilla, Australia is responsible to its citizens So what it needs to do with regard to allegations of torture or human rights abuse, of destruction of passports, which is government property, Australia needs to obviously ensure its citizens are protected from those harms, potential or real.
How can the Australian government respond further to what's happening beyond destruction of government property?
In a way, this is a result of the international community allowing the state of Israel to get away with crimes against humanity at scale. This is an extension of that, an extension of the international community's complicity. What that means is if you've allowed Israel to get away with genocide, crimes against humanity, they will feel the confidence to get away with other sorts of wrongdoing, which includes the mistreatment of Australian peace activists. I'm not entirely sure the Australian government and administration is now in a position to do much because they have allowed the Israeli state to get away with much, much worse.
Associate Professor Srinjoy Bose, Associate Professor in International Relations at the School of Social Sciences, University of New South Wales, speaking there with James Bale. Gold prices have hit record highs, surpassing the $6,000 an ounce mark for the first time. Many people will be eyeing off their parents' jewellery, wondering what it would now be worth. And the gold rush isn't just happening in global markets. At the Perth Mint, more than 7,500 customers have queued each week in the past fortnight, many lining up to buy gold bars as stocks run short. Susan Hu asked Dr. John O'Donoghue, General Manager of the Depository at the Perth Mint, what were the main global forces driving gold to such record highs right now?
There's a number of forces in the market that are driving gold to record highs. If you look at the US, there's concerns about the current government shutdown. There's an impact of the tariffs that came into force previously and how they will play out on the economic strength. There's also uncertainty as to how many interest rate reductions will happen this year. So all those factors, coupled with global factors, is driving people to gold, which is the safe haven asset.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, gold's often seen as a safe haven during turbulent times. Does that reputation still hold true today? And how do we see that playing out?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the answer is yes, gold is still classified and considered a safe haven asset. If you look back over the last 2 years, we've had a lot of uncertainty across the world, be it geopolitical, be it conflicts in various regions. That has propelled people to gold. And then secondly, central banks are buying gold at record levels. And all those factors definitely resonate to the wider community that gold is still the safe haven asset.
Here in Australia, we're seeing people queue outside the Perth Mint to buy gold bars. What does that tell us about public sentiment and confidence in the economy?
I think that's twofold. So gold has definitely become more common across the narrative. If you look back over the last number of months, the price of gold is reported in most of the major news bulletins. It's reported in the paper. It's gaining more traction. So I think that's making more people aware of gold. And as more people buy, there's a momentum trade that happens. And that, I think, brings more people to the party.
Gold is one of Australia's largest exports. What does that mean for the gold industry and for the Perth Mint's operations?
Yeah, gold has been one of the strongest resources in Australia, especially in West Australia. Here at the Perth Mint, we export the majority of our gold around the world. That has been the case for many years, and that will continue to be the case. That continues to support jobs locally in the community.
Some analysts warn prices could fall back. Do you see this as a sustainable shift or more of a speculative bubble?
If you look at the broader market, there could be some short-term selling where people would take profits as no one has hit record highs in US dollar terms and AUD terms in the last couple of days. So you might see some short-term profit-taking. But looking more longer term, most of the analysts predict that gold will continue to be at an elevated level for the medium term.
Aligning with this trend in soaring gold prices, what other resources or minerals do we see with this following a similar trend?
Yeah, gold is attracting a lot of the headlines, but additionally, silver and platinum have both had a really strong performance in 2025. Silver has hit record highs in Australian dollar terms. It's trading over 70 Australian dollars. And platinum has rallied very hard in the last number of months. It's now trading over 1,500 US dollars. Both of these metals are additionally performing like gold.
What do you think explains the forces driving this? Is it the same reasons as gold?
So silver has probably two factors at play. One is it's also considered a safe haven asset, but not to the same extent as gold. And then secondly, silver has an industrial element. So both of those factors are combining to drive the price higher at the minute. And platinum has underperformed for the last number of years compared to gold. So a lot of the upswing in platinum at the minute is more than likely driven by catching up to underperformance.
John O'Donoghue, General Manager of the Depository at the Perth Mint, speaking there with Susan Hu.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Every 3 seconds, a girl is forced into child marriage, ending her education and putting her at risk of abuse. Around the world, nearly one in three women and girls face violence, and in developing countries, half of all girls don't finish primary school. October 11 is the International Day of the Girl Child, and for the first time, both female and male celebrities are joining to support the cause. Yan Wang asked Mel Carswell, Director of Child Sponsorship Content at World Vision, to explain how serious child marriage was for girls around the world.
Every 3 seconds, a girl is forced into child marriage, which is such a horrific thing to think through. And that usually means that her education ends. And often with that, her chances of building a safe or an independent life. And also right now around the world, 122 million girls are out of school globally, which is so hard to comprehend. And of all the girls in the developing world, only half of them will ever finish primary school. And that's why the World Vision 1000 Girls campaign is so important to raise the voices and to raise the issues facing these girls around the world.
So this year's 1000 Voices for 1000 Girls campaign, what makes this year's campaign different from previous ones?
Yeah, fantastic. So the 1000 Girls campaign is in its 7th year. It started right back in 2018. But this year, for the first time ever, we have both male and female ambassadors raising their voice for girls all around the world. We have a whole range of athletes, actors, musicians and media personalities, both male and female. People like Yelena Dokic or Alex Dimona or Rebecca Givney or TikTok star Eunice Wani, and they're all raising their voices for girls around the world.
So how well this 1000 Voices for 1000 Girls campaign practically support vulnerable girls?
So World Vision's work around the world helps girls to access their education, which is so important because we know that their life opportunities open up when they stay in school. It also helps them to be protected against early marriage or to be protected against any violence in the home or gender-based violence. It helps them to understand their rights and to know where to get help if they need it.
Australians are hearing this and may want to lend a hand. How can they get involved and show their support for girls at risk?
Oh, fantastic. We would love Australians to help vulnerable girls around the world. And the easiest and quickest way that they can do that is to sponsor a girl, to sponsor a child with World Vision today.
So, and where can people go to learn more about this campaign and or take actions right now?
Yeah, fantastic. They can go to worldvision.com.au and learn more about how to sponsor a child and the 1,000 Girls campaign. Sponsoring a girl with World Vision is such an incredible thing to do. By sponsoring a child, whether it's a girl or a boy actually with World Vision, you help them get the skills and the tools that they need to overcome poverty and to strengthen their life, their family's life and their community as well. It helps them break free from poverty and it helps them understand their own rights as a human being and how they can advocate for themselves and others as well. Specifically around child, around girls, vulnerable girls and the issues that they face. It helps them to know about child marriage, early child marriage. It helps them to understand about harmful practices that might happen that are harmful to girls and how they can stand up and fight against that for themselves and other girls in their community as well. Sponsorship broadly helps children access education, safe, clean water, helps them to have nutritious diets, helps their family to have the skills and tools to grow their income so that the family has a safety net as well and they're not forced into making really tough decisions, which might include, for example, a girl being married off really young or being sent to work as a child, which, again, we want to keep girls in school. We want to keep opening their opportunities and giving them choices for their adult life. So sponsorship is quite a game changer for vulnerable girls around the world.
Mel Carswell, Director of Child Sponsorship Content at World Vision, speaking there with Yan Wang.
After a hard day out in the paddock, I like to catch up with The Wire. Find out what's going on around this big country.
The Wire, bringing you the stories from all around Australia.
It has been 1 year since Google launched AI Overviews in Australia, which has added AI-generated summaries for over a third of the results that you search for. Today, Google has launched their new AI mode, a search setting similar to Chatbot, which generates conversational answers to queries. Google CEO Sundar Pichai spoke about this new AI technology.
This whole new dedicated AI experience called AI mode coming to search. And in AI mode, you can have a full-on AI experience in search, including follow-on conversational queries. People are typing in queries, like literally long paragraphs. So we are seeing people respond. We kind of know what works. Users are our North Star. And empirically, we see that people are engaging more and using the product more.
With AI being increasingly relied upon to answer our questions, online news sites are seeing a decrease in readership. Amelia Crouch asked RMIT researcher Dr. Joanne Kwai how the introduction of AI in Google's search engine has eroded how we search for information.
So these generative search engines, they will reduce the incentive for the users and audience to click through, and because they present synthesized answers directly on the search page, so they will inevitably cut traffic to the publishers.
Have you encountered any unreliable kind of search results as a result of these summaries?
Yes, because these generative search engines, they're built on large language models, which are probabilistic models. They are not designed to provide accurate, verifiable information. So the research I've done previously have shown that these systems, they were cite sources, they were just wrong, and they will make up quotations and even misattribute or fabricate. So they will create an appearance of transparency, but actually undermining like these trustworthy news outlets.
So if these results are so unreliable, why do you think we give them such authority?
From the user's perspective, it's more because of the convenience. You will look at the synthesized answers and don't have much incentive to click through and just trust them to take them for their face value.
So how would, say, this user experience affect the credibility and ability for, say, online journalism?
The readers here really have an important role to play. So they will have to also take the initiative to learn more about the media landscape, to cultivate their media literacy and AI literacy, and question what they see, where is the information coming from, who are talking, and cultivate a better news habits and also their news diet so they can support quality journalism and also support them even financially.
So that's what audiences can do. What could the media possibly do to help adapt to this?
As of now, the media is really at a disadvantage, especially the smaller newsrooms or even freelance journalists. They don't have any leverage and power when it comes to negotiating deals with these big platforms. They can neither negotiate a good deal, a sign license agreement, or have any kind of like power over them. So it's a really grim picture for the media outlet. But the journalists, it's still not completely hopeless. They can try to diversify their offerings, such as newsletters or podcasts, so to create more direct engagement with the audience and to build this like trust relationship with their audience. So to stand out by having this quality journalism and trustworthy news to stand out for their brand building.
Amelia Crouch speaking there with Dr. Joanne Kawai, an RMIT researcher focusing on AI, search engines and journalism. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.